This coming Sunday, though, would have been Sam Cooke's 75th birthday.
Darling, you send me. I know you send me. Darling, you send me. Honest you do, honest you do, honest you do.
That magical voice animated a long string of hits that came to a sudden end when Sam Cooke was shot and killed in a motel manager's office in 1964 at the age of 33. In a new biography, writer Peter Guralnick traces Sam Cooke's career. He began singing with his brothers and sisters in his father's church in Chicago, became a star on the gospel circuit, and then broke through. Along with Ray Charles, Cooke was among the first to cross over from gospel to pop. Like other black stars, he struggled with white-owned record companies, but Sam Cooke went ahead and formed his own record label. Like the rest of his generation, he got caught up in the civil rights movement. Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke, sets the singer and songwriter in the context of his times, of his ambitions, of his enormous accomplishments, and describes his darker side as well. Later in the program, the Vatican newspaper weighs in on intelligent design. But first, if you have a question about the life and times of Sam Cooke, give us a call or send us an email. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is talk@npr.org. Peter Guralnick joins us now from the studios of WBUR, our member station in Boston, Massachusetts. Nice to have you on the program, Peter.
Well, it's good to be here.
This may sound like a strange question, but everybody knows You Send Me and Chain Gang and Wonderful World and A Change Is Gonna Come and more. But do people really remember Sam Cooke?
Well, I think that's just one of the anomalies of creativity in any field, is that if the work has any worth, it will survive. But often the creator may be lost sight of for periods of time. I mean, somebody like John Donne disappeared for 300 years. Robert Johnson disappeared for 50. I think in the case of Sam Cooke, I think that his celebrity or his fame was definitely cut down by the fact that he died so young. But his songs have never gone away.
He died also at a time when it seemed he was nationally known, internationally known, but on the cusp of even greater renown.
Well, he was really on the cusp of so many things. I mean, the one thing about Sam Cooke is that he was always moving forward. There was never a period of life. There was never a period in his life from the time he was 5 years old where he didn't have a sense of strong forward motion. And at the end of his life, he envisioned any number of new advances. For one thing, he was making a more and more explicit commitment to the civil rights movement, had set up a benefit performance for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, had his song, A Change Is Going to Come, adopted as a kind of anthem for the movement. But in addition to that, he was planning to play supper clubs to open in Las Vegas. He had just signed a movie contract. And on the last night of his life, he spoke of going into the studio in the next month and recording a Gut Bucket Blues album, which would be influenced by his great love for the music of Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and John Lee Hooker. So, I mean, we tend to compartmentalize things, and we often say, oh, if somebody goes in this direction, they can't possibly go in that direction. I mean, they might sell out by doing this if we don't like it. But in Sam's case, he truly believed. He had been brought up by his father to believe, never allow anyone else to set any limits for you, never put any limits on yourself. And he genuinely didn't. He really believed he could do it all.
Sam Cooke's father, a minister, an itinerant minister much of his life, but for most of his childhood there in Chicago. But he started him singing with his brothers and sisters in a little group that they took around to various places. And then he joined other local groups and became an absolute star. And I don't think people understand this. On the gospel circuit when he was the lead singer with a group called the Soul Stirrers.
Well, that's right. I mean, he was, in essence, a kind of matinee idol on the gospel circuit. I mean, there were other great stars there. There were Archie Brownlee with the Five Blind Boys, was a great, great singer and a star in his own right. And there was someone like June Cheeks with the Sensational Nightingales. But Sam, as Bobby Womack, who was a protege of his, who met Sam when he was only 7 or 8 years old, Bobby Womack always likes to say, Sam brought sex into the church. And, you know, while that may not be explicitly true, or it may be, I'm not sure, but, you know, he attracted an audience and he had a kind of seductive style that was new to quartet singing. Most of the singers that he was going up against, like Archie Brownlee, like June Cheeks, Kylo Turner and Keith Barber with the Pilgrim Travelers, who traveled all over with these soul stirrers, they were more shouters. They were, in some cases, they were screamers, but they really put their music out there by the volume that they created and the passion that they communicated. And it's not that what Sam was doing it was better or worse, but what he was doing, he was a crooner in that field, and he brought teenagers into the church, he brought young girls, and he brought an atmosphere, a kind of seductiveness into the music, which was natural to cross over into pop music.
Let's hear a little clip of Sam Cooke with the Soul Stirrers and one of their biggest hits, Jesus Gave Me Water.
Oh, Jesus gave me water. Jesus gave me water. Jesus gave me water. I want to let his praises swell. Jesus gave me water. Jesus gave me water. Jesus gave me water. And it was not where there was a woman from Samaria.
And interestingly, that we listen to that, Peter Guralnick, we can hear Sam Cooke's voice. It sounds a little light, a little young. We don't hear that characteristic sound that he had in so many of his pop and R&B records that, whoa, I'm not going to try to do it, that whoa, 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 whoa.
I think you should do it.
Another career, maybe.
But no, I mean, that was something that he developed. I mean, he came close to it. He came up in the wake of another great lead singer, R.H. Harris, who really set the tone for all of the quartet singing in the 40s and 50s. And Harris had what he called a yodel, and it was really almost a natural break into a falsetto that really was almost as natural as his regular voice. Mm. And it was that break between his, you know, what you would call his natural range into the falsetto that created the yodel. Well, Sam couldn't really do that, and eventually he created, I'm going to leave it to you to do the whoa, whoa, whoa.
Okay.
But, you know, he created that almost as compensation. But I although people say that, I'm really not convinced of it. I think that he was developing his own style, and in fact, it should be pointed out that Jesus Gave Me Water was the very first record that came out with him as lead singer with the Soul Stirrers. He was just 20 years old when he recorded it.
Boy, he sounds so confident there.
He does. And the point is, this was a song the owner of the label, Art Rupp, the specialty records owner, was adamantly opposed to the Soul Stirrers recording this with this kid. He didn't want the kid to record at all, but he definitely didn't want to record that song because it had just been a hit for the Pilgrim Travelers on Specialty and every single gospel group.
Which was Art Rupp's label, yeah.
Which was Art Rupp's label, exactly. And every gospel group, it seemed, had recorded Jesus Gave Me Water. Well, Sam had been singing it with his teenage gospel group that he had been with just before the Soul Stirrers, the Highway QCs, and it was so much his signature tune that the manager for the Soul Stirrers, S.R. Crane, and the Pilgrim Travelers manager, J.W. Alexander, who was a great champion of Sam's, insisted, give him a chance. And you can hear the result there. And although you're right, his voice is light, you can hear it break in places, but nonetheless, there's so much confidence. And again, even without that characteristic yodel, there's still such a remarkable sense of a style of his own.
Peter Guralnick's new book is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. If you'd like to join the conversation, 800-989-8255 or send us email talk@npr.org. And let's take some callers. This is Tony. Tony's calling from Portland, Indiana.
Hello, yes. I love the show.
Thank you.
And the subject's great because his music stirs my soul. What was his relationship with Lou Rawls?
Well, Lou Rawls was a kind of protege of Sam's. I mean, Lou Rawls grew up in Chicago, and as Lou Rawls said, you just wanted to hang around with Sam, because you knew that there was so much happening, there was always going to be some fallout for you. And Lou Rawls came up in gospel groups like the Holy Wonders and the Teenage Kings of Harmony and their Queen, which were secondary to the gospel group that Sam was singing in as a teenager, the Highway QCs. And basically, Lou Rawls' whole career, when he entered what you might call the big time in gospel, it was as the lead singer with the Pilgrim Travelers after he got out of the Army, which Sam's friend and business partner J.W. Alexander managed and brought Lou into the Pilgrim Travelers. J.W. became Lou's great guide and to some extent his manager, brought him to Capitol Records, and Lou sang on many of Sam's records, sang backup, the most notable one being Bring It On Home to Me, which Sam recorded in 62 and which really marked a return on Sam's part to the kind of gospel sound.
And wasn't Sam Cooke one of the original members of the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame?
He was. He was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I think, in 86, which with Elvis Presley and Little Richard and Chuck Berry and James Brown. And you know, it was a great class.
Well, thank you for remembering him.
Tony, thanks for the call. I just wanted to read an excerpt from Peter Guralnick's book. This is from L.C. Cook, Sam's brother, talking about his brother when he was very young. "I figured out my life, man," he said. "I'm never going to have a 9-to-5 job." I said, "What do you mean, Sam?" He said, "Man, I figured out the whole system." He said, "It's designed if you work to keep you working. All you do is live from payday to payday. At the end of the week, you broke again." He said, "The system is designed like that." And I'm listening. I'm 7, and he's 9, and he's talking about the system. I said, "What are you going to do then if you ain't going to work, Sam?" He said, "I'm going to sing, and I'm going to make me a lot of money." And that's just what he did. There's a man who knew what he was going to do with his life.
Well, exactly. And, you know, his brother, L.C., while he is certainly a reflective person and somebody who has his own insights, to this day, the system doesn't mean anything to L.C. I mean, when he speaks of Sam telling him that, he's referring to a child who became an adult with a deeply analytic cast of mind. I mean, all his life, Sam really set himself to figure out how do things work and how do I move ahead within the framework of the way that things work.
We're talking with Peter Guralnick. His new book is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about gospel, pop, and R&B legend Sam Cooke today. Our guest is Peter Guralnick. His newest book is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. If you'd like to read an excerpt of the book and listen to some of Sam Cooke's music, you can visit our website at npr.org. And if you want to speak with Peter Guralnick, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email address is talk@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. This is David. David's with us from Kansas City.
Hi.
Hi, David.
I'm a huge Sam Cooke fan, but also kind of an amateur musician. And a year or so ago, I tried to look for sheet music, you know, piano guitar music for Sam Cooke songs, and I found that almost none of it was available. The only thing you could buy commercially was a collection of his very, very early stuff, which was primarily the gospel music. And it got me wondering, of the later songs of Sam Cooke that most of us know, Wonderful World, Change is Gonna Come, Bring It Home to Me, how many of those were actually written or by Sam Cooke or Sam Cooke compositions, or and to what extent was his music owned by other people and controlled by other people?
Everyone was written by Sam Cooke, and everyone was controlled by Sam Cooke, because he started in 1959 with his friend J.W. Alexander. He started his own publishing company, Keggs Music, which was actually named for Lou Rawls's stepfather, Keg. His nickname was Keg because he was an amateur bartender. But so Sam, again, in line with that quote from his brother L.C. at the age of 9, Sam saw the system for what it was, and really with J.W. Alexander's tutorial, because J.W. was 15 or 20 years older than Sam, he learned early on that the music business is a business, and that at the heart of the business, the heart of the business is ownership. That's where you make your money.
I was just wondering if there must be some reason that his estate or the people who later took control of his music have chosen not to issue. The records are out there, of course, but you can't purchase sheet music to it.
I don't know what the politics of sheet music are. I mean, I don't know or the business of sheet music. I know that there's a booklet which is with all the songs from Sam Cooke's Sire Record Story, which is the label that Neil was talking about earlier, the label that he and J.W. owned, and on which they recorded people like Johnny Taylor, the Sims Twins, the Valentinos, the Soul Stirrers. Most of those songs are also songs that he wrote. And there's a booklet with sheet music for each of the songs on that 2-CD set. But I know that when Portrait of a Legend came out a couple of years ago, the intent was to have a book. This is all of his greatest hits. It's on the ABCO label. And the intention was to put out a book with that sheet music, but I never followed up on it. And I'm sure you're right. I'm sure you seem to have pursued it, and
He wrote all those songs, huh?
Yep.
He wrote them all, and he wrote all the songs for all of his artists, or virtually all of the songs for all of his artists on Sire Records.
What a genius. He was the best.
David, thanks for the call. Good luck looking for the music.
All right.
You mentioned Sire Records. Art Roop mentioned earlier, the guy who ran Specialty Records. He and Sam had a lot of professional problem. Sam thought he was being ripped off and ended up leaving Art Roop feeling like he had been ripped off. Sam formed his own company, Sar Records, but then he went to work for a big-time label. He was recording for RCA.
Well, yeah, I mean, actually, the company that he went to after when he left Specialty, and you're right, they both, Art Roop and Sam, felt seriously abused. Each felt abused by the other in a business sense. But Sam went to a label that didn't have a name initially, but was when it was formed over the summer of 57, and when his record, You Send Me, was the first record on that Keen label, which was owned by an airplane parts manufacturer named John Siamis. While he was on Keen, he started his own label, which was Sar Records, in 1959, basically to record the Soulsters. But he himself was never on his own label. He and J.W. recorded, as J.W. said. J.W. was just a wonderful person and a great mentor to Sam, and eventually, much later in his life, to me too. But J.W. said we recorded people we liked. But Sam went from Keen Records to RCA with the idea of, you know, not staying on his own label, because he believed that, you know, what he wanted was major label exposure. He believed that he could compete in the same marketplace as Elvis Presley, say, and he was the second biggest single seller on RCA behind Elvis Presley.
One of his big hits for RCA, Chain Gang. Let's take a listen.
Saying
don't you know
that's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang.
Sam Cooke and Chain Gang. As a songwriter, Peter Guralnick, he liked to describe things that he saw. This is one of many occasions you describe in the book where he saw something happen and said, that's a song, and proceeded to write it down.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mean, he carried a notebook with him everywhere he went. I mean, just like that Norman Mailer story in Advertisements for Myself, the notebook. He just, everywhere he went, he carried a notebook to jot his, and if he didn't have a notebook, he'd write it down on a napkin. But he saw himself as a kind of reporter, so that, as you say, I mean, he saw this chain gang in the Carolinas. He and his brother Charles, I don't think he'd ever seen a chain gang before. He and Charles went and got cigarettes for the prisoners, but he wrote the song that he wrote, rather than being a social protest song, is almost a romantic song about the women back home and when they get back home. And actually, if you were to listen to the session tapes of it, and you see how the song evolves, It's fascinating how he takes a real-life situation and he sees it as a kind of drama, but he develops it almost like a fiction writer along lines that his imagination suggests. And similarly, I mean, he saw these dancers at the Peppermint Lounge just, doing the twist at the Peppermint Lounge, high society doing the twist at the Peppermint Lounge on TV, and then wrote the song Twisting the Night Away, in which he peoples with characters. I mean, these are very brief character sketches, but the idea is to create a scene and to create a kind of storyline, and he believed deeply in simplicity, so that it was a matter of presenting a characters and a storyline that the listener could immediately grasp, and a melody, as he said, that the person walking down the street could pick up on and could hum to himself or herself.
Well, let's get another caller on the line. Jim. Jim's calling from Tucson, Arizona.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
I wanted to ask your guest if he's familiar with any alcohol problems Sam Cooke had.
No, I wouldn't say he that he had any alcohol problem. He drank. His son, Vincent, drowned in.
I hired him in 1964-65, our fraternity in a university I was going to, and he got off the plane in Enid, Oklahoma. And he stood on the tarmac, and he goes, "Here I am in Oklahoma City." He was in Eden. Lots of pigs, lots of cattle, lots of nothing. Oh, New York, New York. where's my skyscraper? As he turned around two or three times. And then he couldn't even, by that night, that was the afternoon, and by that evening, he went on, and he couldn't even do the second part of the act. We had to have the comedian and the band do a second round, and people were upset and everything. And I was curious.
Yeah, I don't know. No, I mean, he met a very demanding schedule. He performed probably as much as, 200, 250 nights a year. I've never heard a story like that. I've never seen a show that he missed. I've never, I've spoken to hundreds of people, and so I think that was very uncharacteristic of. But that certainly that doesn't. He was certainly after the death of his son Vincent in I think May of 1963. He was depressed, and he drank more. But as far as meeting his professional responsibilities, both in terms of an extremely demanding, live performance schedule, in terms of maintaining a recording schedule and recording the artist on his own label, and really constantly being on the go and constantly meeting his obligations and always. And improving his possibility, his situation, there was never any evidence of that kind of behavior.
You were mentioning, though, his son Vince, who as a baby fell into a swimming pool. The cover had been left off, and that not all that far from the end of Sam's life.
No, and I think that marked a period of great sadness, even in the midst of great achievement. So that while his career and while on the surface everything went well, it marked a there was both self-blame and I think both he and his wife Barbara blamed each other, so that it led to a great deal of friction in a marriage which already had its mm-hmm. share of friction.
Yeah, if you could say and be truthful that he married his childhood sweetheart, and that would be the most misleading thing you could probably say.
Well, it wouldn't, because in a certain way, I think they never fell out of love, but the love that they shared was not the love that exists in storybooks. It was not an easy kind of love, and there was constant friction. And I think the great heartbreak in his wife's life, who was perceived in many different ways by many people around her, but who was perhaps one of the most honest people that I've ever met, one of the most brutally honest in terms of not just other people but herself, just the great heartbreak of her life was that she never could make a place for herself in Sam's. That while she would have given anything to have become more a part of his life, of his not just his professional life, but I mean of his whole life, and she did everything she could to do that. But I mean, it's funny. Like so many entertainers, I would say that at heart, Sam was an almost solitary person, and I think you find that to be true of a great many entertainers who go out charm the world. And yet, in their own selves, are more contemplative, more solitary, and more brooding than you would ever imagine from their public persona.
Hey, had that ability you describe of being what people wanted him to be, being utterly sincere and convincing mm-hmm. at the moment that they were with him, but being able to turn on that, being detached from that in the same way, almost as if he's observing himself.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I mean, you can call that a protean personality, or you can, but I think that it suggests the same problems of intimacy again that so many entertainers have, or so many people have. I mean, it's unfair just to put it on it, but entertainers are placed in the position. Entertainers like politicians. It's similar to you can see this, let's say, in someone like Bill Clinton or in Elvis, both of whom clearly want to be loved by everybody, and put forth a persona that allows them to be loved and accepted by the crowd. But the question is, who are they, when they're by themselves at night?
We're talking with Peter Guralnick about his new book, Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's talk now with Nordine. Nordine calling us from Tucson, Arizona.
Yes. Hi, Pete. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
I just was wondered if Pete had was aware of the impact that Sam Cooke made in my generation. He really listened to his song, especially the song you just played, the Chain Gang, and he really, really inspired us and helped us all. And to
I'm sorry, Nordine, we're having trouble hearing you. Did you say you grew up in France?
Yes, I'm French, and I moved about 10 years ago here. And I moved because I was inspired by Sam Cooke. Sam Cooke is and was an icon, an American icon in Europe, especially in France.
Did you know the words when you were listening?
I didn't know the words. We're singing after him, and we're just inspired by his voice and the music. And until this day, now that I understand everything that he says, it's really moving, you know, and I just want your listeners to know that Sam Cooke had in an impact on all of us in France, especially North African children dealing with racism.
No, Nordine, thank you very much for the call.
Thanks so much.
Appreciate that. And I guess Peter Guralnick, there's a testament.
Well, you know, I think that to some extent is a testament as well to the universality of music. I mean, the way in which, say, the blues has reached around the world to an audience that may very well not understand the words. But it's the way in which that's that direct impact communication of the songs of someone like Sam Cooke, of a whole variety of people, and the emotional core that lies at the heart of Sam Cooke's songs that allows them to communicate in a way that is beyond language, I think. It's what Ray Charles said of him. I spoke to Ray Charles just a few months before he died, and he said, you know, Sam Cooke was the one and only. He knew Sam from the time Sam was singing with the Soul Stirrers. They would get together. They would all be staying at the same little hotels because, of course, black entertainers, whether they were gospel singers or they were R&B singers or pop singers, or if they were sports figures, there was only one little hotel in town that would take African Americans. They couldn't stay in a white hotel. So on Sunday morning, Ray Charles would talk about how he would get together with J.W. Alexander and the Pilgrim Travelers and Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers and how they would just sing gospel music. But he said of Sam, Sam was the one and only. Not only did he hit every note, he hit every note with feeling. And as Ray pointed out to me, he says, I'm not one to hand out compliments lightly.
those stories about those meetings, either backstage or in those hotels, there's a description of a scene with Clyde McFadder, I think on one of the tours, another person who came from gospel, but of Clyde McFadder and Sam Cooke trading lines and songs. And you would have given anything to be there.
Yeah, no. I mean, it's just the musicality of these singers. I mean, and it's something that it hasn't been lost. But I mean, when we talk about the golden age of gospel, which was, you know, roughly, say, from 1950 to 1960, but continued. I mean, you have great, great gospel singing. The Mighty Clouds of Joy came in right around 60 or 61. But the point is that it was just every night you had the kind of exchanges and the kind of competition that is almost beyond imagining. And then on, you know, with the soul shows, I mean, I used to usher the soul shows where you would have Otis Redding and Solomon Burke and Jackie Wilson. And again, I mean, these are the shows that Sam would go out with, Sam and Jackie Wilson, for example. And the competition and the way in which the music alone would elevate them, you know, beyond anything that can be imagined from the records alone. And anyone who's ever been at any of those shows, and what you described was in a backstage thing, which I think either Phil or Don Everly described to me. He said that they would be singing country and western songs, Clyde McFadder and Sam Cooke backstage. But just the sheer musicality and the way in which music served as an instrument of communication. I know that I wish I had the eloquence, but Sam Phillips just used to declaim to me about the way in which music had changed the world, could change the world, would continue to change the world. You know, he would say, you know, put some of those musicians over there in Iraq and that would be the end of the war.
Well, not sure about that, but music
we could hope.
Music helped change the country in the early 60s, and of course what was going on in the countries changed a lot of the music as well, and we'll talk about that with Peter Guralnick when we come back from a break. Again, his new book is about the triumph of Sam Cooke. It's called Dream Boogie. 800-989-8255. Talk of the Nation has an email address, too. That's talk@npr.org. And this is NPR News. Today we're talking about gospel, pop, and R&B legend Sam Cooke. With us is Peter Guralnick. His new biography is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. If you'd like to read an excerpt of that book and listen to some of Sam Cooke's classic songs, you can visit our website at npr.org. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, 800-989-8255 or email us talk@npr.org. And let's get another caller on the line. This is Michael. Michael's calling us from Cleveland.
Neil, how are you?
I'm well, Michael.
Great. Peter, thank you very much for the book. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, well, thank you.
And I have a story that I'd like to share from you. I'm originally from Brooklyn, New York. And a local group, the Five Star Gospel Singers, would open for Sam Cooke and the Soul Stirrers when they would come into town. And my father was a member of that group. And it was a performance where Sam really lit the church up. And he made my mother cry so much that after the performance, when I was with my father, my father said, "Say hi to Sam." I wouldn't say hi. My father said, "Why won't you say hi?" And I said, "Because he made mommy cry."
Now, would that be at Washington Temple in Brooklyn?
That was Brown's Memorial Baptist Church in Brooklyn,
uh-huh.
Right off of Gates in Washington.
That's a great story, Michael.
Peter, thank you very much, and keep it up. I enjoyed both of the books.
Well, thanks. I hope you were at the shows in Cleveland, the tribute to Sam Cooke.
I was out of town, and I missed it, but I heard it was really great.
Michael, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Neil. Appreciate the show.
Sam Cooke had that effect on a lot of women.
Yeah, no, he could make them cry. And I mean, it was a deeply emotional kind of music. And Sam's whole point was that if you couldn't bring that emotion to it, if you couldn't bring that feeling to it, then don't do it. I mean, that was the core of the music, despite the fact that he was a deeply reflective person, a highly analytic person, and really an intellectual, somebody who was not just a voracious reader, but someone who pursued his reading in directions. For example, he was inspired by the work of John Hope Franklin, from Slavery to Freedom, to begin his study of black history. And he soon acquired a library of black history and that would rival anybody's. He used to go out to a bookstore in Los Angeles called the Aquarian Bookstore, one of the few in the country that had that kind of, those kinds of books. But the point is that for all of that, for all of his intellectuality, for all of his acuity of mind, for all of his the way in which he his analytic cast of mind, his whole point about music was you had to bring the feeling to it, and that's what brought the feeling out in the audiences.
Let's talk now with John. John calling from Syracuse, New York.
Yes, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I had recently read the autobiography of Malcolm X, which I highly recommend to everyone. And in researching Sam Cooke recently, I understand with Malcolm X at the Liston Clay fight in the early 60s. And my question is about Sam Cooke's politics. I know that at the time of his death he had written Change Is Gonna Come. I'm wondering what kind of political activities he was undertaking and what he might have undertaken.
You know how long ago it was, still referred to as Cassius Clay. Of course, we know him as Muhammad Ali.
Yes. I'm just at the time.
Cassius Clay. Peter Gralnick?
Well, I mean, again, as a deeply reflective person, as a person of color in a world in which the color line was clearly drawn and in which prejudice was not just prevalent but just omnivorous, Sam was somebody who was deeply sensitive to racial issues, to racial hurt, and who, in the course of his career, took a number of stands that some entertainers did and some entertainers didn't. I mean, for example, he and Clyde McFatter refused to play in Memphis at Ellis Auditorium at a segregated show after the NAACP had requested them not to play it, and everybody else on the bill played, and Sam and Clyde McFatter refused and made statements to the paper at risk to themselves, at personal peril, with financial threats and the threat of their cars being confiscated. And there were any number of incidents like that, including his refusal to be turned away from a segregated motel in Shreveport, Louisiana, which was one of the three points of impetus for his writing, A Change Is Gonna Come. But I think that he was becoming more and more explicit in his political activity, more and more of an activist towards the end of his life. And in fact, after the fight in Miami, after Cassius Clay beat Sonny Liston in Miami, because he, as you pointed out, he was yet to become Muhammad Ali, Clay, rather than going to the Fontainebleau for a big victory party that had been planned, or going off with his girlfriend Dee Dee, I'm forgetting her last name right now, went back to the Hampton House where Malcolm X was staying with Sam, with Jim Brown, And the FBI informant who was there reported back to J. Edgar Hoover with considerable alarm that these sports and entertainment figures should be getting together to express their common dissatisfaction over issues of color. So more and more, over the course of the last few years of his life, Sam was not just aware of something which no person of color could fail to be aware of. He more and more he was inclined to take action, and he had donated his song "A Change Is Going to Come" to an album, which was a benefit album for the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in the summer of '64. There were any number of things which he had planned.
John, thanks very much.
Yes, thank you.
And Peter Gronick, we just have a couple of minutes left, but you've said earlier Sam Cooke did not have an alcohol problem as such. People in your book say repeatedly he never smoked dope, never took pills.
Right.
There was a dark side of his character, though. He was a womanizer, and the night he died, he was certainly drunk.
He had been drinking, certainly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, and was I don't think there's any way of measuring how much he had drunk, but he certainly had been drinking. I think the point is that like if you look to anybody else in the book, he was in the life like everybody else in the book, like Ray Charles, like Lloyd Price, like B.B. King, I think you would be hard pressed to find anyone who wasn't a womanizer, which is neither to condemn or condone. But what was so difficult about his death to accept was it simply people couldn't accept it because it simply wasn't the way it should have been. And I think that, you know, for someone as smooth, as urbane, as sophisticated as Sam Cooke, it simply should not have come to an end in that way. Now, that's as if there were some rational impulse behind the way in which any of us die. But as J.W. Alexander said, and J.W. believed that this was his friend, this was his best friend in the world, and he felt that it was a tragic accident, it was simply a senseless waste of life. He didn't doubt that it happened the way it was said to have happened, but I think to see it as a senseless waste of life would be the best way to see it. But the way in which the community reacted to it was essentially I think there was almost universal disbelief because Sam was such a shining light within the black community. And conspiracies that were constructed to explain it all make perfect sense, in the sense that they see Sam as being this was a case of another proud black man struck down by the white establishment that just couldn't stand to see him get any bigger, which in view of the prevalent, you know, the prejudice that was so pervasive that was ran through every aspect of American life and continues to in many respects, it's a perfectly rational explanation. And maybe, you know, tomorrow somebody's going to walk in the door with the evidence to prove any one of these theories. But so far, no evidence has been presented.
Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. Peter Gorelnik, thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thanks. I've really enjoyed it.
You mentioned Change Is Going to Come, an anthem of sorts for the civil rights movement. Let's go out this segment listening to that.
Just like the river I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. 'Cause I don't know what's up there beyond the sky. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
Sam Cooke, A Change Is Gonna Come. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.